But now my feelings about that, you know, are different as far as like doing psychedelics by yourself now that I've, you know, had the ayahuasca circle experience.
Yeah.
Where it's very much not a solo by yourself psychonautic thing. It's a group.
It's so impactful. It's so impactful.
So impactful.
And again, like that makes me think of punk too. I mean, I've told you a little bit of my story being like this isolated kid who really like, I didn't really see any place in the world for me. Like the bass guitar was the one thing that I thought would give me some kind of meaning. And it kind of did. It definitely did. It definitely saved me in those early years, like age 13. But it was finding other people and reconnecting with Tim and having a band and playing out and recognizing like, oh, there's actually like, there's this entire world right just surrounding me. Like, I mean, back to the mushroom analogy, you walk in the forest and then suddenly you see that you're surrounded by fungi everywhere, which you hadn't seen before. That's what that felt like to me.
Mm. Yeah. Speaking of your band with Tim, we should mention the Vile Cherubs is the band that like mm-hmm. you guys did together that has records out and people can listen to the Vile Cherubs if you don't already know the music.
We did record one album, but we did two demo tapes before then. They're much better, same songs, much better, just like much rougher. Jeff Turner
from Gray Matter. Isn't it? The great demos.
Yeah. Well,
and you try and perfect it, and it's not quite as.
So it was kind of funny. Like Tim and I were talking about that recently, and we did the demo tapes, and we were, you know, that was like our first studio experience, and like, you know, studio in quotes because it was Jeff's basement with like a Tiak 4-track and mattresses around the walls. Those demos are great. Like he nailed it. Like he really had his thing down. And of course, like listen to Gray Matter. I mean, that's a total, you know, punk/60s punk/garage. Like it's really blends them so perfectly.
What were the Vile Cherubs' main influences? Like you were listening to garage rock and.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was all like 60s stuff, like Chocolate Watch Band and The Music Machine. And then the 80s bands who were covering them, right? Like the Morlocks and the Gravedigger Five and the Fuzz Tones and the Chester.
Did you listen to Telltale Hearts?
Telltale Hearts. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, did you listen to my interview with Sam Nee from A Scene in Between?
No.
Okay.
Oh,
should listen to that episode.
See and Tweet. Yeah, they. I follow them on Instagram.
Oh yeah,
they're so good.
So good. Yeah, so you got to hear my conversation with Sam.
Okay, I'll do that.
You'll love it.
I'll do that.
Talks a lot about. He's very much that world.
Yeah, yeah, and of course, like that also like totally that spoke to me because I loved punk. You know, I found my older sister and her record collection, and that was just like, you know, my world opening. And bands like The Jam. But there was something about the 60s punk stuff that spoke to me even clearer because it was more secretive. Like it was harder to find, harder to understand. Like I loved the idea that like, remember this is the 80s. So like 20 years before, alienated teens had made this really raw and sometimes kind of weird and sometimes pretty inept music. But it really spoke to me.
Yeah.
You know?
It was a punk scene, you know?
It was a punk scene
that like every band in America that wanted to be the Rolling Stones in a garage in Texas was, you know?
Yes.
Just out there doing it.
Yeah. Making really raw. Like I said, there's even like some of the stuff is just like really, you know, it's difficult to listen now because it's just like put downs of girls
who didn't
love the singer or who
didn't. Classic Rolling Stones type material.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is one reason I never really jived to the Rolling Stones either. But some of it has like a really weird mystical edge. Like, you know, teens who were doing acid and seeing the same things that you were and that I was later. Like, oh, there's something behind this, you know, there's something to be found here. So, yeah, we played what we called 60s punk. And that kind of, we were kind of an oddity in DC for sure. Cause there were some suburban bands who played that and like bands like the Cynics from Pittsburgh would come down. But, we definitely stood out. So we sort of just like slipped into the scene in this weird way, which is really magical. I mean, like we were really young. Like I was trying to figure this out with Tim and Jesse. There was a, what's a pod, End On It.
End on End podcast, yeah, the DC that, punk one.
Yeah, that's the one that like looks at each
deep
every,
detail very, of like every. I've only heard a few episodes, but yeah, it's like just like
okay.
Okay, let's talk about the inscription in the inner groove sure, of Marginal important. Man's third 12 yeah, inch.
You want to know that.
People do want to know.
Which was actually really delightful. I mean, like, I'm still close with Jesse and Tim, but like to actually sit down and talk about all that stuff and just how lucky we were to be young and have a, you know, be totally welcomed by that scene as yeah, these kind of weirdos. And just understanding that there was like, that was the forest full of mushrooms. Like, oh my God, there's kids all around us doing not quite the same thing, but we're all in the same.
So cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a cool thing to discover that there's such a vital thing happening in your backyard.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, again, like I think back to the jam and that feeling, just that feeling of like righteousness, not self-righteousness, but righteousness. Like, yeah, oh my God, like this guy is totally speaking truth. And the music is so sharp and cutting. And of course they look amazing.
It's very empowering and inspiring.
Very empowering. And then like the jump from the jam to Fugazi is not very broad at all. You know, like I even listen to some of the jam songs like, oh yeah, I totally hear Fugazi and that and vice. I mean, actually there was a clothing swap at like Pirate House, like one of the DC group houses. And I think I still have it. I think it's Guy's jam t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, totally. Like that's, he plays a Rickenbacker. I know he's a huge jam fan.
Oh yeah.
It's like, there's a, you know, there's lineage too.
For sure. I always think of DC people as loving the Damned. That seemed like
yes,
a band that was so huge in DC amongst, and I had never really known that much about the Damned. I mean, obviously their first couple songs, but
yeah,
you know, it wasn't a band that was like huge for me. I didn't really have many records, but then all the DC people were just like, the Damned is the band.
They were a DC band.
Yeah.
I feel like obviously Empire is another one of those that like, oh, the Ruts.
Oh, yeah. I love the Ruts. Yeah. Yeah.
But like they were DC people's bands. And I don't yeah, know if like, you know, Skip at Yesterday and Today just happened to stock their records. You know what I mean? Like yeah, someone did something to make these people aware, like, oh, here's this thing happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Damned, amazing.
Yeah, and back then, like, one influential record store buyer could, like, shape a scene, you know?
Well, think about the personalities of the people involved. And, like, yeah, sure, it's a scene of a few hundred people, but, like, what are you all doing? You're all going to see this one band, or you're all reading this zine, or you're all going to this protest at DuPont Circle. Like everyone is going to the same things and cross pollinating, but there are personalities and there's that sort of set the tone.
Right.
You know what I mean? It is very personal in that way.
Oh yeah.
You know? And again, like getting back to like, well, what made DC special? It was only leaving it, like either to go on tour or later, you know, I uprooted and moved to San Francisco and I recognized like, oh, that was really, really special. Like that doesn't really just happen.
So in San Francisco, what was your psychedelic use like then
no, that was like
interaction.
That was like, so I left DC and to be honest, like when I left DC, I think I was pretty dependent on marijuana.
Mm.
You know, like you don't really get physically addicted, but you can develop a psychological addiction. And I really felt like I was being, that was what was protecting me from the world.
Mm.
You know, even in the scene, even in a place where I felt seen and accepted, like I was just, that was my own issues, my own, you know, undealt with history and trauma. So I moved to San Francisco and I thought, oh, I'm going to go on the straight and narrow, like no more weed. I'm going to go to cooking school. I'm going to work really hard. And, you know, I did. I became a food writer. I got a job at City Search, if you remember that.
Yeah.
That online journal or whatever.
I think it's still around, isn't it?
No,
it's
long gone. Okay. It's so funny, like that was such a big deal. I remember the national editors being like, you know what, in 5 years all the weeklies like the Bay Guardian, they're gonna be gone.
It'll all just be City Search.
Yeah. And like now you cannot even like, you can't even like look for archives of City Search. It's so vanished. It's like, wow, good job guys, it really worked out for you.
Killed it.
But, yeah, so I was like totally on the straight and narrow and psychedelics were something that felt like they felt kind of childish,
mm.
you know, because remember, like, I mean, in the '80s, for me at least, when I was doing psychedelics, it was deeply meaningful, but it was also like people didn't talk about them in therapeutic terms right. then. It was like, basically I was like, well, Nancy Reagan says that drugs are bad, so I have to do drugs. Like there's no, you know, self growth, self development part in this. It's just like, I want to be weird and bad. I just didn't see them in a sort of therapeutic context. So it was only much later when, that I was reintroduced to them. And that's when my life profoundly changed too.
And also maybe when you're 24 and you're just sort of striking out in a new city and you've got this direction, like this isn't the time where you're seeking therapeutic intervention. You're just yeah. living. And, you know, later in life you might be like, okay, let's get to the bottom of some things.
That's totally true.
And to the front of some things and the sides and the tops and the underneath. And psychedelics can be really good for that.
Yeah.
So when were you called back, or how, what was that, later therapeutic interaction with them? When did that happen?
So I'm in San Francisco. I have like the straight job. I met the person who would become my wife, Juliana, who you know.
Yes, she's wonderful. Very talented artist and wonderful person.
Extremely talented. And we moved up here to Portland. We started a family. But I really had no, I think I had no way to see what was happening beneath the surface of me, you know, my family story, my upbringing, my own issues, my own stuff. I had so little way of seeing that I didn't even believe that it was possible. You know what I mean? Like you can't see something until you see it. But stuff began to unravel. Like my marriage and home life were really unhappy. I was really unfulfilled. I was trying to make a go of it doing music. I was playing in bands here, but more than that, doing like recording bands and like doing demos for commercials and trying to do film scores and stuff. And it was just like not working. And I couldn't really accept that or see that. And
not working how, like professionally or just in terms of artistic fulfillment?
Both.
Yeah.
Totally. Like the surrendering to spirit.
Yeah.
That is, I think, the necessary part of the creative process.
The joy of creating.
There was no way. No, it was all control. Like, yeah. I'm going to control it. And look, I built a recording studio in my basement.
Yeah, I remember it. It was nice.
Yeah,
I recorded there once with you.
Yeah. I still remember, what's it? A song about chicken plucking?
We'll talk about that.
Yeah, it's a good one. But like a studio is about control, right? Like separate the sounds, control them, manage them. And that's what I wanted. I wanted that sense of control and safety behind it. And Juliana and I were actually, we went to see a marriage counselor because we were breaking up. Like things were, and we had a young daughter at this point too. Like things are totally falling apart. And I just could not see any other way. And back to the, you know, we were talking about medicalized psychedelics earlier. This therapist by chance essentially was someone who worked with psychedelics and said, do you want to try a session with MDMA? And that changed everything.
Had you ever used MDMA before?
Nope. No, totally missed it as a kid. Like I was into I was into anything I could find as a young person, but like I totally missed MDMA.
I remember when it came out, you know, first as a prescription medication in San Diego when I was in high school, there was like a bunch of kids. There was like the stoner wall or whatever, the bunker wall that we would hang out in. And I remember these kids would be like, I'm on this stuff called ecstasy. And uh-huh. it's like a drug you get from a therapist. And my mom had some and it's best, and they would just be, you know, vibing out, and I never tried it, but I was always like, huh, you know, they're doing it at school, they're not like on acid, they're not freaking out,
yeah, they're like coherent,
acting really weird, but they're obviously having a great time. And I don't know, at the time I just wasn't interested in trying anything like that. But go on. So she suggested MDMA therapy.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Well, I want to put a pin in the idea of, like, you know, I feel like earlier I was saying I have a lot of doubts about the medicalization of psychedelics, but at the same time, I'm someone who benefited immensely. Like my life is hugely different because a therapist, you know, a clinician,
yeah,
was willing to try this.
Yeah, it's not about it being one way or the other. It's like, yeah, however you get there, it's good. It's just that it shouldn't just be one way.
Yeah, I mean, I know you
and
know
MDMA
that.
Also being, it's like a, you know, invented pharmaceutical.
I'm trying to remember what it was invented for, though. It's old. It's over 100 years old. And I thought it was, there was a respiratory element to it. And it was basically sort of tested and forgotten and then rediscovered. Obviously, I don't know the complete story, but this stuff fascinates me. But anyway, yeah, the MDMA. So, you know, as you know, like MDMA isn't what you would call a psychedelic in the technical sense. Like it's not a trippy drug. You could call it an entactogen or an entheogen, something that helps you connect with the divine. But it sort of erases fear. There's a term for it, fear. I think it's like fear memory extinction, which is why it's so great for people who are suffering from PTSD. You can revisit and reconnect with those parts of you. When you experience trauma, severe trauma, parts of you have to go underground. It's too much for the mind to bear. And I think of those as orphan parts, like parts that are separated in the darkness. They can't reconnect with you. And I think most people do a really good job of living for years or decades or their whole lives with those orphan parts never being touched upon. But MDMA makes it much easier to find those places again and to reconnect with them. And what it did for me was, my trauma was that my mother died suddenly when I was 4. Mm. That was the family trauma.
That's a big one.
That split up Tim and I because our mothers were close.
Oh.
And my father remarried very quickly. He wanted to find a new mother for his kids. But I think for my stepmother, Tim's mother was kind of a reminder of that previous life. So she really separated us, which is, yeah, I think my life would have turned out very, very differently had things been different then, had people been able to put it into context.
Right.
Right. But they couldn't for various reasons. But MDMA cracked that open. It allowed me to touch on that, the grief of that, and just to understand for the first time that it was there at all, right? I think for so many years prior to that, I was operating in the way that I thought that I was supposed to be. Like, I'm going to work. I'm going to forge this career. I'm going to do the normal things that people do. I don't understand why I'm not happy and why I'm not connecting with other people.
Because it looks right on the outside.
Because it looks right on the outside.
Yeah.
And Juliana saw this. She knew what was happening, but I couldn't see it yet. But once we set that first MDMA session and the two that followed it, that was when everything started to change.
You did those together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the therapist?
Yes.
And the therapist are you doing talk therapy kind of through it or?
Kind of. It's more just sort of being with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's more, I think like a good guide is able to hold more energy than words. You know, right. I think like there's a lot of sort of guidance and ethics about how you function as a guide, which is you're not leading the story. You know, you're allowing what wants to surface and be seen and felt and heard.
Yeah, and creating a sense of safety, which is just such a huge thing that, you know, yeah, you've got someone there if things go off the rails.
And that's a nice thing about MDMA too. I mean, it's a very gentle, loving experience.
You don't really go off the rails.
Yeah. So speaking of going off the rails, that led to ayahuasca.
Mm-hmm. How did that lead to that?
Same person. The therapist wondered if that would be useful for us. And it was. I was terrified of it. I really, I knew this would be, you know, jumping into the deep end. But
how many years had it been since you had a profound psychedelic experience?
Right. I'm trying to remember that. At least at least a decade. I would say more like since my teens, really. There was actually a night in DC that I want to talk about. We should get back to that. But that
what is the night in DC?
So that was a night. So, you know, everyone who didn't grow up in the DC scene, and many people who did, you know, you equate it with straight edge.
Like, yes.
Right. But there's one night. This would have been about 1990, I want to say, that summer, kind of before everything blew up. And in one of the group houses near mine, I lived at a house called the Embassy, where Nation of Ulysses lived.
Yeah, I remember that place.
Yeah, yeah. But a couple blocks away was this house of kind of slightly older punks, like people from Grey Matter and people who did zines. I think Nikki from Fire Party, I think she lived there. Maybe she just hung out there.
Previous Traeger Method guest.
Nikki Thomas?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how awesome. Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I reconnected with her talking about this night, which is, I mean, she's such a star.
Yeah. She's amazing.
Yeah. She's amazing.
You got to listen to that episode. You got to go back and do your Traeger
Method. I have to go back.
Due diligence.
Is there time to like insert a plug? Like, how does this work? If you act now, you can
act now. They're all on.
They're all still there.
They're all there.
Free. Just listen. Do it.
Okay.
But a guy named Gordon
Ornelas. I know Gordon. Gordon.
I figured you would.
Cynthia introduced me to him and his God. Video collection.
Oh, dude.
Traumatized for life.
Traumatized for life. Okay, yeah. So the Vile Cherubs is still happening. I am 15 or maybe 16. The rest of the band are like a year older, 6 months older. But like, we're like making the scene. We play DC Space once or twice. And we're like, you know, this band of young weirdos. And after one of the space shows, Gordon's like, hey, you guys, I'm having like a video watch. And you guys should come over to it.
Don't tell me you took psychedelics and watched Gordon's videos.
I don't believe I was on psychedelics.
You don't need them.
But what I remember is we're sitting in his living room and he puts on this tape with that evil grin of his.
Yeah.
And it is reels of vintage bestiality videos.
Yeah.
Like from the 50s and 60s. I'm just like, what?
The classic stuff.
What? How is that? They can do that?
Yeah, that's a thing.
And so there's maybe like 45 minutes of this. And it's like, and also remember like, how young I am. Like, is this how adults hang out? Like, is this what normal people do?
Just put on some, yeah.
Yeah, in vintage bestiality, enjoy a drink or two.
Yeah.
The reel ended with footage of, I forget his name, but he was like the state treasurer of Pennsylvania.
I saw the same video collection that you saw. He pulled it out for everybody. The Bud Dwyer.
Yeah, Bud Dwyer. Bud Dwyer. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. In which he shoots himself.
Yeah.
In the head during a press conference. And
you just see it, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I will never forget that night.
No.
Thank you, Gordon.
Etched in my mind. I have a few memories of different, not vintage bestiality, but
more modern.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Some eel stuff I had never imagined before that stayed with me in a very
about that.
Deep dreamlike, nightmarish, images that are like, there's something about when you're seeing the real thing, it's like, wow, that's not CGI. That is incredibly, yeah. Yeah, that was, and then a lot of, scatological stuff that also just haunts me.
I want to say like a quartet of older Dutch or German
people
and like snifters of cognac.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, we saw the same reels.
Wow.
Maybe we were there at the same night. Who knows?
That'd be amazing.
But yeah, I know, I imagine this is probably a screening he did quite a few times.
Yeah.
I was very mad at Cynthia for introducing me to Gordon.
Yeah, not cool. not actually cool.
And again, that was one of those images that I was probably a teenager too, and I remember being like, this is not what I thought I'd be doing, like in the DC, when I visited like the DC punk scene, that I'm just like going to be
clean
watching.
Clean living.
Like, yeah, clean living, staying with Ian, and then I go watch like, most.
Well, Gordon extreme. Was also, I mean, obviously like he was like the shit stirrer.
Literally.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, punk scenes are always actually, the reality of all punk scenes were like, it's just completely messy and there's all kinds of weirdos and just every kind of person is in there. It's never like some.
But yeah, like his need to like just tweak everything way farther than it should or could be done. I remember he told me.
Edgelord before the term existed.
Edgelord, yeah.
You know.
He, so we worked together at DC Space. Like he would cook and I was a dishwasher. So he introduced me to some amazing music like that no one in DC seemed to be like Flipper and just like, you know, fucked up punk stuff yeah. that I didn't have access to. And then he would put on like, do you remember that collection called Hooked on Classics?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's like classical music with like a rock beat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he would like put that on and blast that and like really jarring. But he told me things like, oh, well, you know those photos of teen idols with X's on their hands. You know why they have the X's on their hands? I'm like, yeah, because they're straight edge. They don't, you know, they can go to the show, but they can't drink. It's like, no. They tried to go to the bar, but the bouncer put the X on their hand. You know, basically like, yeah, they're trying to get fucked up, but they got busted. Like, you know, just like shit stirring.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so this one night in 1990, Gordon told me, I guess at DC Space, like, I'm going to have a mushroom party this weekend, you should come. And I loved psychedelics, but I didn't have many people I could share that with, you know, in that scene. And especially in that time, like, you know, Adams Morgan is becoming the land of punk group houses. They're all straight edge. Like there's, you know, the rules are starting to come in a different way. So this sounded really exciting to me. And I got there after work. I want to say it was a Friday or Saturday night. And I felt like I already missed it. Like I'd been going for hours and I was like in the second round. But I drank this mushroom tea that he had brewed and it was still extremely potent. And what I remember is just this incredible sense of belonging with these people. And just the beauty. I mean, it was like a ratty DC row house, but the beauty of the people and their creativity that was infusing this, that I was surrounded by all these incredibly creative, brilliant persons and just a sense of togetherness and belonging that I don't really think I'd ever felt mm-hmm. before. And my memory of that night is that there were dozens and dozens of us in that house all tripping together. And what was funny, well, first of all, no one talked about it afterwards. It's sort of like it happened and then like everyone's like, nope, gone. So there wasn't really any touchstone to revisit. But recently, I think like last year, I reached out to the people I remembered being there, one of them being Nikki, just to sort of jar my own memory because I wanted to write about this and to see what their experiences were. And it was deeply meaningful for everyone who was there. But there was like 8 people there. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, there's like hundreds of people. Like, no. Oh, here comes Evelyn, my daughter. It's probably going to get loud for a second.
Okay, so you were talking. Move the mic a little bit down and towards you.
Like, oops.
There you go. Perfect. Cool. Okay, tell us about that night.
Yeah, I mean, just like it was a touchstone for me. And in the way that psychedelics function, like it's hard to pull, you know, concrete details back from it. although it was very funny, like I talked to Cynthia because I was sure she was there. And she's like, no, I totally wasn't. Like, I remember it happening, but I wasn't there. You know, like, are you sure? And I'm on the phone with her, but I'm also at my laptop and I was communicating with Gordon, like over message, it was Messenger or something. And he didn't have any memories of it, but he said, I do remember the next morning, someone had written something on the wall. It was like the slogan of the night. And it said, it is what is, which is such like a thing people would say when they were tripping. But I'm on the phone with Cynthia. I said, oh, Gordon just wrote, it is what is. And she totally cracked up like with that amazing cackle of hers. Like, oh my God, I was there. Like she was totally there, but had forgotten about it for decades. Nikki also had a memory of Gordon screening another film, The Trojan Women.
Mm-hmm.
But like he had his like old, like just fucked up TV in his room, and he like, you know, on old TVs you could mess with the hue,
yes,
and the alignment and stuff. So he made it totally like insane, like
wonky.
And she's like, something told me I should not I should not be in that room. But it's really sweet. Like, definitely this kind of like melding of worlds. Because, I mean, again, like, there's that tension of belonging, unbelonging, and psychedelics were a way to get deeper into connections. But it was also like, it had to be kind of secret, was my sense. You know, it was like definitely not cool and above board to be using any kind of drugs in that scene, you know, especially something kind of like more impactful like psychedelics. But it just felt like this one night where everything coalesced and this moment of real, just a very beautiful togetherness that I don't really think I felt before or since. At the end of high school, so my band with Tim, the Vile Cherubs, we played DC Space. The first time was in 86, so I'm 15 years old. And I very clearly remember, I mean, a little bit ago, and I said that psychedelics felt like a homecoming to me. I remember the first time I went to DC Space, which was the bottom two floors of this pre-Civil War brick building downtown. And it was, you know, it's downtown DC in the 80s. Like, the neighborhood was literally falling apart. I remember Cynthia and I talked about this, that after those torrential rains that would come, you know, without warning, you'd literally smell, when this, you know, the rain stops, the sun comes out, and there's all this steam wafting up from the roofs. You would smell the decay. I mean, like, stuff is falling apart. Like, a lot of the buildings were abandoned.
Yeah, I was there at that time. I remember it.
Yeah. But DC Space was this oasis. I mean, it was really like this magical place.
It was.
And the first time I went in, and there was that old, like, weather-beaten, like, steel and glass door, the hex tiles, the bar, the old sinks, the pressed tin roofs, you know, the beaten up cafe chairs.
Yeah, the aura of history.
Yeah. And I just felt a really profound sense of homecoming. And I started working there pretty quickly. I worked there, I started when I was 17. I was a bar back and a dishwasher. So I was still in high school at this point. And my world just exploded because there was a real downtown art scene then. And it was also a place where black and white DC mixed. And that was just such not a thing. Like, such not a thing being like, race didn't seem like an issue there at all. And there were not that many places in DC where that actually happened in that kind of way. And it was really blue collar. There were, you know, wealthier prep school kids, which is where I came from. There, it was a really queer scene, but very, there was just something so leveling and like open about it. Like, yeah, big deal. You are X or Y or Z. We're all here at this bar in this performance area. And that was just such a really like my world turning into color.
Mm.
But a year or so later, when the scene kind of coalesced in this way, like I moved into a group house with Tim and with James Canty.
Canty.
Pretty soon that became kind of codified. Like, there was ways of dressing again, and certain things were cool. And
they make you
things.
Wear the Nation of Ulysses uniform.
I was actually thinking about this the other day. So there was like, so James made a stencil, right, to spray paint the mechanics jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came turn for mine, I covered up Nation of Ulysses. I just wanted the stars and bars.
Yeah.
And he was, you could tell like he was, that offended. Was not cool.
Just like, I mean, the DC Nation, stars and bars.
Nation of Ulysses was an amazing band. I mean, like, no question about that. But they were also, they were the apex of that kind of like, this is what is cool.
Yeah.
And I also remember too, like, my best friend, my oldest friend is Tim Green, and Tim Green joined that band. So, you know, it felt like he was in the enemy camp, you know? And so I think that's when that scene began to feel, there was a really unloving part of it. Like, it felt so open and possible when I discovered DC Space. And then it really felt like I was back in high school. And that was not a good time for me.
How long after that did you move to San Francisco?
Well,
95, you said.
Yeah. So this is like 1990 or so.
Yeah.
I moved to Arlington with Jeff Turner and a bunch of other folks. I was like, I'm going to get the hell out of here. And as soon as I did, I was in a motorcycle accident. Mm. I was hit by a car. Oof. Very early in the morning in downtown DC.
How bad?
Well, what happened? I broke both my ankles and my elbow, and I think my nose was kind of messed up too. And yeah, that was gnarly. That was an impactful night for a lot of reasons.
Literally
too.
Impactful.
Yeah, thank you.
It hit
hard. But I got out of that. I was in the hospital for about 2 weeks, and I forgot this. So you know, hospitals, they all have chapels. And there's a TV in every room, of course. And one of the channels is the closed circuit TV on the altar in the chapel.
Oh, uh-huh. So you right? can watch
yeah.
services.
You watch, right. And Nikki Chapman and Alec Bourgeois came to visit one day. And they saw the chapel TV. And they're like, oh, you should keep that on. Like they left. We said goodbye. About 5 minutes later, you know, it's like a ceiling-mounted camera.
Yeah.
Suddenly, like, Nikki's face is the entire screen. Like, Alec must have put her on his shoulder or something. Anyway, like, they turned off the chapel TV after that. Like, they just canceled chapel TV. Like, no one can watch it anymore.
They got a shot. What band was Alec in? He was in a good band I liked.
So, I think his early band was Serial Killer or no.
But there's one after that.
Well, Severin.
Severin.
And Dusters after that.
Duster yeah. was so good.
But there's like, you know, there's that 7-inch comp that's like Mission Impossible, Serial Killers, maybe Grey Matter. I think Grey Matter's on that, like that version of Walk the Line. Anyway, yeah. So Alec grew up on Capitol Hill, and he was older than the Vile Cherubs, but Jesse Quitsland, the singer and guitar player in Vile Cherubs, was also on the Hill. So they were old friends. So there was that Hill connection. But anyway, so I moved out to Arlington and kind of escaped the scene, and I'm laid up. And it was pretty bleak time. And then I got a call from Chris Thompson, who was in Ignition before that. And what, Lunch Meat before then.
Mm-hmm.
And he had moved to Wisconsin and started Circus Lupus with people from Wisconsin. But he said, hey, we're going to move back to DC and I think we're going to lose our bass player. Do you want to join? So I healed up. I drove out to Madison and joined the band. And then we played our way back to DC that summer of 91.
Awesome. How did that feel?
That felt like finally everything had clicked into place. Like all the sense of unbelonging in the scene.
You had your crew.
You mean when I joined that band?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Like now I had a crew again, and the music was just so thrilling. Like it really didn't sound. I mean, you know, Chris is kind of like the archetypal DC punk in some ways, but the band definitely didn't sound like DC punk music. You know,
yeah.
I'm still not quite sure what it sounded like, but it didn't sound like that. And yeah, that was definitely like I think a high point for me, you know, having a functional band that was doing something that really interested me and caught on with other people for sure. But you know, we had our moment, but like we didn't, I think about this now, like we really didn't know how to be a band. Like we didn't know how to communicate with each other as people. And you could probably say that of any successful band or most successful bands, you know what I mean? But for whatever reason, we didn't have what it took to, you know, that was also the DC curse. Like you make two albums, go to Europe and break up. And that's what happened with us.
You never toured the States beyond that, like sort of regional.
We did one full U.S. tour. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. I was actually just on the phone with Sarah Lund.
Oh, yeah.
Before you came over.
Nice.
And I reminded her that we met at our show in Olympia.
Oh, in Olympia.
Before she was in Unwound. We were playing with Unwound, but she wasn't in the band yet. It was literally 30 years ago. It was April.
Brandt was the drummer.
Yep. Yep. But yeah, we did a bunch of regional stuff. We went to Canada a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we just didn't know how do we make this a thing, you know? And I think on a technical level too, like, I really love the way that first record, we made two albums together, and I really love the way the first one sounded. It was really just kind of dirty and gnarly and just kind of chaotic sounding, like things sound like they're falling apart to me. And the second one, we couldn't get anyone to produce it. Like Eli Janney had produced the first one, but he was busy. Ian MacKay was going to produce it, but then he was busy. Jay Robbins, like all these people dropped out. So it was just sort of us. And without someone to give it a kind of focus, like that sound. I mean, I know I'm veering off into the technical here, but
it's fine.
Yeah, I figured as much. But like, a lot, I hate to say it, like, no disrespect to Don Zientara in any way, shape, or form, but a lot of those recordings don't stand up. Don doesn't have a punk aesthetic. Like, making it dirty and raw is not his point of view as an engineer. I mean, he's an audio person, right? So I think like the actually great sounding DC records, there's usually someone in there who needs to fuck it up.
Yeah,
seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he's going for too clean a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, talking about the Vile Cherubs, we made those two demos with Jeff, which we loved, you know, they sounded dirty and weird and not like anything else. And then instead of just like making an LP from those tapes, like we didn't realize you could do that. You can master from a cassette tape. Right. We went to Inner Ear and like, okay, well, now we're going to make a real record.
It has to be done right.
It has to be done right.
Yeah.
And Tim said the other day, like, yeah, I think we spend our whole budget on overdubs. You know what I mean? Like instead of mixing it and making it sound cool, like we recorded everything we could. Like, I remember like laying the bass on a table and like playing it with a violin bow and just like just stupid shit you couldn't hear.
Like, don't waste your time.
Why are we doing this? And then like, yeah, the record just sounds like clean and the vocals are way too hot. You know, it doesn't stand up. But,
So Circus Lupus, how long did that last? Just like 4 years?
Oh God, not even. No.
Three.
No, I joined, they had been a band for probably like a year and a half or something. They had made like a single. I joined in the summer of 91. We toured Europe in February, March 93. And that was it. We went for 7 weeks, which is way too fucking long to go on tour for.
7 weeks.
Especially with
months.
People you're not really working it out with. A lot of that was with Lungfish. That was
pretty awesome to see that every night. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was a joy. That was really fun and funny. But yeah, it just like we ground ourselves to a pulp and it's like, yeah, why? Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
Nice.